Welcome back to the third series of Unlocking the SDGs, a blueprint for the future. In this podcast, we explore the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, and what they mean for society. I'm Professor Preeti Parikh, Professor of Infrastructure Engineering and International Development at the Bartlett, UCL School of Sustainable Construction.
And I'm Professor Monica Lackenpool, Professor of Integrated Community Child Health in the UCL Greater Ormond Street Institute for Child Health. In this episode, we're discussing the role of mental well-being in relation to the goals. Last series, we began to unpack some of those issues relating to mental health and well-being with Dr. Nora Vera San Juan and Dr. Kerry Wong. And today, we're taking a deeper dive into the issue.
Our guests today are Professor Essie Widding from the UCL Department of Clinical, Educational and Health Psychology and Professor Argyris Dingaris from the UCL Divisions of Psychiatry and Psychology and Language Sciences. In addition to their roles in research and education, they are the joint leaders of the new UCL Grand Challenge team of mental health and well-being, which aims to support cross-disciplinary responses to this complex issue. Congratulations and a warm welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Professor Widding, Professor Stingaris, thank you so much for joining us today. We've talked a lot in the past here about how the issues contained within the goals are cross-disciplinary. But, you know, sometimes we don't really know what cross-disciplinarity means and people get very confused about interdisciplinarity, cross-disciplinarity. So just wondering, what does, from your perspective, cross-disciplinarity mean?
So from our perspective, we see cross-disciplinarity as something that is absolutely central for improving mental health and well-being. Humans are very complex. They're complex as individuals, and they're also complex in terms of being embedded into close social relationship and larger societal structures. So in order for us to really understand what promotes well-being and what we can do to improve mental health, we really need to understand everything from DNA and molecules to psychological processes, social relationships, built environment, and inequalities. Even climate change comes there in terms of thinking about things that influence our mental health, our well-being. And Argyris, do you want to say something about how we think about this in relation to the grand challenges?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I, as Essie said, this is central to our goals as well for the grand challenges. But I was also reflecting coming here on my way to this podcast about the SDGs themselves, the Sustainable Development Goals themselves. So there are many themes in there, right? But many of them are interconnected. So how can you think about poverty if you are not going to think about how someone lives in a city or climate emergencies? And how can you think about war without thinking about these other issues? And how can you think about all that without thinking about mental health? Because these can both have an effect on mental health, but can also be affected themselves by mental health. So they're clearly interrelated, and therefore the subject matter itself calls for cross-disciplinarity. The university structure in general, but in particular UCL's structure, is quite uniquely placed to tackle some of these problems. And the reason is that we have quite broad expertise. We have lots of different faculties, divisions, departments, individuals, scientists who do an extraordinarily varied and diverse research. And we also go into a lot of depth with that, which is the advantage of academia. We have the opportunity, we're being paid to do exactly that, go into depth into understanding these problems. So grand challenges are really trying to encourage people across UCL to do what we haven't been particularly good at doing, which is talk to each other and work together and, you know, look at goals like the SDGs and say, okay, what can we all do together to promote that? So it's about incentivizing that, you know, and making it clear to everybody how important it is.
So you've sort of addressed one of the things I was thinking about is that when we think of mental health in a global perspective and we're thinking about how does it affect people wherever you are in the world, mental health is something at the core of everybody's personality, yeah. Isn't it? It's something that we think about. But actually, we work in silos. I've just sort of alluded to. How do we actually get people to break those silos and realize that mental health is actually everybody's problem, everybody's issue, and it's actually at the core of every single discipline that we work to if we want to address these global challenges that we have?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things. One is trust, fostering trust between you. Fostering trust requires fostering a common language so that people understand each other and realize, as they often do, that they talk about the same thing, but sometimes using different words. Curiosity, which I think is kind of finding out, oh, what exactly are you doing at architecture or at engineering, right? And let me show you what we do. And then I think because we're all humans, you know, there is also the incentive structures. So, you know, there is a lot of talk about inter or cross-disciplinarity, but are the funds there to go to a, you know, funding body and say, well, here we are, you know, we are doing something cross-disciplinary, where you don't come up against the reviewing process, just to talk very practically, where it's very hard to find a reviewer who will do the engineering bit, one who will do the architecture bit, and another one who will do the medical bit, you know, and another one who will do the philosophy. So it's very, very hard from that point of view. So creating the culture change within our institution, but also within our funders, is another very important component. I'm talking very practical here, but I hope it makes sense.
Well, I hope you have two exemplars here. So Prithi's, you know, her specialty, environment and engineering, and mine, health. And we went off to India together, looking at toilets together. And, you know, we were testing out the toilets, actually. We actually walked into the toilets, opened the doors. I learned a huge amount about engineering. And I think Prithi learned a lot about toilets. Nutrition. And behavior. And talk about what is it like to sit on a dirty toilet? How does that affect your mental health? How does it make you feel if you can't actually find a place to go to the toilet? So all of these things that maybe engineers wouldn't think of, but also for me, think about the structural side of the engineering side and how that might help. Exactly. Exactly.
And it's really this cross-fertilization of concepts, ideas and theories, which leads to this interdisciplinary way of working to address grand challenges. Essie, I was wondering if you wanted to come in on that.
Yes, so, I mean, we have thought about this, as Argus already said, much at the start of this. We've visited people across UCL. That's what we spent our first few months doing. And we've also organized networking events and calls that specifically promote networking and pump priming calls that you can only apply for if you engage in work across different disciplines. So this is the incentive structure in practice, you know. You can get money, but you can only get money if you work across these silos. And I think there is probably much that we can do within our institutional culture as well in terms of showing to people that we value this sort of work, which sometimes doesn't fit into the departmental workloads or quotas. But some of this change will probably, some of it will come from, no doubt, university-wide initiatives. But it will also be bottom up. Mostly we do our best work when it's something that we are really excited about and we find somebody who we have chemistry with and we really want to work with. So I think part of this is we sort of see ourselves as academic matchmakers a little bit with the funds that are available from the grand challenges. And we are consistently in awe of the amazing work that is done at different parts of UCL, all the way from philosophy and law to neuroscience and population health. And we really want to see how this work can come together and go to a next level in doing something that really pushes the envelope, which I think you can only do if you bring together these different strands of excellence, which individually and in their silos are amazing at UCL. But how do we get them to come together so that they catalyze something that is more than a sum of its parts? That's the challenge.
And absolutely. I mean, if we want to address some of those big challenges, grand challenges facing us, whether it's the climate crisis, whether it's mental health, whether it's conflict, we need to really break down those silos to achieve impact. And in our last series, we considered the importance of mental health as an indicator of equality and well-being in a society. And Dr. Kerry Wong, who joined us, highlighted the role of the social determinants of health and how addressing issues like poverty can in turn have knock-on effects for people's mental well-being, indirectly helping to achieve the SDGs. How can academic research improve our understanding of those kind of interconnected relationships that you've alluded to previously?
Well, we have lots of different methodologies that we can bring to bear on a problem. We can study the individual all the way from their genes to their brain to their behavior, but also we can try and understand how that individual embedded in a particular context may grow up. So we have, for instance, animal models that can show us that even genetically identical animals will end up showing different phenotypes depending on context in which they are in. And we are beginning to do that type of research in humans as well. Of course, it's a lot more complex. We cannot, you know, randomize humans into different environments or get neat sort of genetically identical unless we look at twins humans. But there are methods that we can use to study the complex interplay between the individual's biological propensities and their environments. And I think we're making quite solid progress there, but we could always do more. And the problem in the area of mental health has been traditionally lack of funding. So Arguris often talks about, you know, cancer research in comparison to mental health research. His wife works in cancer research, which has been much better funded for decades. But the discoveries only came when the funding got ramped up. And I think what we have in mental health at the moment is traditionally quite small pots of funding, which people have sort of scrapped over, and we perhaps haven't collaborated and gone across silos as much as possible because the incentive structure hasn't quite been there. Do you want to add?
I think that covers really a lot, and the landscape is fortunately changing. And indeed, UCL grand challenges, which perhaps we should say this to your listeners so that they kind of know, UCL has had these grand challenges programs for a while, and what they are meant to do is to tackle big societal problems. There's four or five going on at the same time, and now this is a new round of grand challenges. And indeed, it's the first time that mental health and well-being have come up
together. Well-being has been there before, but this is
both together, and it has funding. So it is a substantial investment, not just in material terms, but also in terms of, you know, signaling to the outside world and to people within the university what matters. So that's a big shift for us, I think, and quite a welcome one.
So can I ask a bit of a controversial question now? Mm-hmm. It's something I've grappled with, you know, when I've been thinking about mental health for many years in relation to global health, children, adults, whatever age you're talking about. Mental health is something that affects all ages. And the word mental health, the word mental, I find sometimes when I go to other countries, particularly in the global south, the word mental is a very negative terminology. Mm-hmm. And that actually hinders policy changes. It actually hinders research. It actually hinders advocacy as well because of this word mental health when you translate it into other languages. And I've also had people going, I'm not mental. Why do you keep saying I'm mental? Do you not think that terminology that we've perpetuated actually hinders progress?
I think it's probably debatable. So if you think about even in the global north, there was a huge stigma around mental health, which actually has reduced over the years. And actually young people now are quite happy to talk about their mental health and their mental health problems, which to me suggests that how the words are experienced can be shifted. I'm not necessarily hugely kind of wedded to exact terminology myself, but what I am wedded to is that there is a common framework so that when people do research and when they talk about something, they know what they're talking about, as opposed to that being unclear. I also, possibly controversially, I'm not somebody who has a problem with something being sometimes called a problem or a difficulty, because in certain cases, much as, you know, for physical health, something's really disable you and make your life harder. I think that it is true. And even people with lived experience would come forward and say, for me, this is disabling at times. And I think we need to be able to talk about the fact that mental health difficulties can really be something that hinders someone from achieving their full potential. We're not just talking about differences in mental health. We are in some cases really talking about genuine disabling problems.
I was wondering, from the global perspective, the word mental, any thoughts about where that first came from? I was trying to work out where it did. Because if you convert it, for instance, when I go to India and we talk about mental health and you do a translation, it comes across very differently in the language.
And it may be, you know, it's a very interesting problem. And, you know, I've worked in various contexts, including Greece, obviously, and in Germany. And terms, even within the English-speaking countries, terms can be experienced differently. So I think it is crucial that one also works with the local communities and one has a good grasp of the native language to know what is best. Because I agree, there's no point in using a terminology that will put off people. On the other hand, sometimes simply changing the terminology, invites a chase of the terminology in its own right. So, you know, the stigma catches up with the terminology rather than changing. So it's a difficult act. I think we have inherited some of the terminology from, you know, some of the terminology is Cartesian, comes from Descartes, right? It is kind of mind-body dualism.
That's right.
Which is from, so there's the mental realm, right? And then there is the physical realm. Now, it's obviously, you know, a bit silly to be thinking in those terms, given what we know about the body and the mind these days. But these terms have stayed with us. Maybe there will be better terms. I've been arguing for a long time that the term depression, for example, is problematic. But, you know, I can't, you know, I have to, as Essie was saying, you know, I have to kind of communicate with others and therefore I'm still using it. But I wouldn't feel terribly sorry if I saw the back of it at some point.
I think it's quite an interesting thing from the SDG perspective, you know, terminology to win people for policy change and action. We don't really work with linguists a lot to really think how is the narrative expressed.
And can I add to that? There is this interesting assumption that people make that, for example, emotions are universal. Emotions are probably not universal. So there are emotions that are broadly experienced by many, many different people, but there are emotions that are unique to certain cultures, they're maybe even unique to certain people. So there's a lot of variety and heterogeneity in experienced emotions. If that's true of emotions, then that's true of mental states of other kinds as well, particularly those mental states that rely a lot on emotions. And their language and linguistics and understanding of how these things are expressed play obviously a very big role. But there's always a danger to not slip into complete solecism, you know, do you know what I mean? Like being able to talk to people, have a common understanding, whilst also being aware of the connotations of the words.
So coming and acknowledging the difficulties perhaps is a sort of a key, acknowledging the fact that, you know, language is an imperfect medium. We have to have some core agreements of what we call things if we want to transfer knowledge and know that we're talking about the same things, we're using the same definitions, whilst, as Argyris says, also being mindful to both cultural sensitivities but also individual, you know, sensitivities. We know that not two people may fill the same diagnostic criteria as we have it now, but may actually experience their presentation very, very differently. It may mean very different subjective things to them.
We're talking about people who talk different languages, children and adolescents, really. They talk a very different language than us, especially with social media and other ways of communication. So, Essie, your background, I understand, is in child and adolescent mental health.
So it's Argyris, it's both of
us. Both of you. Yep. Which is an area of health provision in the UK that's probably struggled with demand. We have an increasing number of young people who are presenting with mental health problems or along the spectrum, emotional challenges sometimes. And funding in recent years has increased, but probably still lagging.
Nowhere near in line with the demand.
So thinking about what the issues are with policymakers, how do you think we need to be addressing policymakers, particularly to help young people more who might be experiencing mental health problems?
So again, it's not a one silver bullet solution because the problem is complex. And as you alluded yourself, people are at different places along the continuum. And also this is a developmental issue. People, we know from longitudinal data that people sort of wax and wane out of experiencing high levels of symptoms, remitting, maybe moving across what we currently perceive as different diagnostic categories across their development. So it's a really complex issue. We also know that most of the mental health problems start in adolescence and early adulthood. So I would say that the first thing that the policymakers ought to have as a priority, and I know in fact that this is in the Labour Mental Health Manifesto, an area that they are very keen on, is prevention. And by prevention, I don't just mean universal prevention, everyone gets some low-level thing because, you know, there are people who need more. But I mean early intervention. So you have perhaps elevated levels of symptoms. Could you get something that involves perhaps social prescribing, some individual attention early on before you develop a level of problems that mean that you're much more at risk of having a chronic trajectory? So if I had to name one priority, and it's a priority that even though we might target it in children and young people, actually would have repercussions for adult mental health care and also for older adult mental health care, that would be prevention and early intervention.
I completely agree with that, what Essie's saying. I would make another perhaps controversial point, which is we must take a step back and kind of think again about what mental illness is, because there's certainly, it looks very likely rather that there has been an increase in certain problems and obviously some of these problems are debilitating, that they have deleterious effects on people. But there is also a reasonable assumption that one can make that A, rising levels of awareness and destigmatization of mental health might make people think that they have mental health problems when in fact they're experiencing you know, what would come under normal adversity or only ephemeral problems. And that can be particularly relevant to young people. And labeling these problems as mental health problems has implications for them. So the striking the right balance is quite important, particularly because this affects the whole population. By extension, interventions that we introduce, particularly those that are at the population level, that are scalable, we have to make sure that they don't have unintended consequences. And these are very rarely examined, unfortunately, have been very rarely examined. So there's some work that Lucy Falks, and to an extent I, have done recently, and others, trying to understand these problems, precisely because they could compound an already existing issue. And then the third thing is healthcare systems globally face underfunding. In fact, if one looks in the Western world at the funding of healthcare system, it has been plateauing over the last, you know, 5-6 years. And there was a peak during COVID, but then it's flattened again. So this means that, you know, we'll be cash strapped. So being efficient with what we have becomes an imperative, being good at what we do. So we should ask for more money, but we should also make sure that what we do is efficacious, is good, really delivers what needs to be delivered, particularly to those who need it the most. As a practitioner, which is part of my life, what I see is that often people who need care don't get it, and those who get care don't necessarily need it. And that's inefficient, to say the least.
And this also comes back to the cross-disciplinarity approach as well, of what are the unintended consequences? What are the trade-offs? You do something. Yeah. We were talking about it yesterday, weren't we? About, you know, you think that you're moving somebody into better housing, which is so important. I mean, that's a passion of mine, looking at people living in temporary accommodation and the impact on them. Yeah. You think you're doing something good, which is moving them into better accommodation. Actually, those young people then lose their friends. They then disconnect from society. They then disconnect from feeling comfortable within the school that they're going. So there's, on one hand, you think you're improving something. On the other hand, you cause a
That really highlights the multifaceted interconnected nature of, you know, what goes into making good mental health or not. I think what Argyris has just been saying about the sort of the importance of being more efficient is really, really critical. And part of that will come from better applying knowledge that we already have, but part of it will come from generating new cross-disciplinary knowledge that allows us to make more accurate models, more multifactorial models of mental health. Quite often these days, many of us in our research have been one or two trick ponies. So we look at, you know, a few aspects of what goes into good mental health. And I think your example you just gave is a very good one. In when you start thinking holistically, suddenly the problem space gets quite complex. But, you know, we have new analytical solutions that are coming up all the time. We are improving measurement of things. And again, you know, when we hopefully get a bit more money coming into this area, we can do more complex research that will allow more precision and more causal inference. So allows us to move more from correlational designs to understanding the causal levers. And something that Argyris and I have talked about a lot is how can we find the best ways of studying what we call positive causal levers? Because by the time someone is on a risk trajectory, a lot of complex things have happened to them already. And they're complex things that we have no control over. But what we can do is use interventions to study positive causal mechanisms. And I think doing that well in a cross-disciplinary framework could really produce some interesting results.
As an engineer, I'm finding the conversation absolutely fantastic. And I'm thinking about those links, those connections and complexities that I've not considered before. And the SDGs offers a framework with 17 goals, 169 targets, where we can explore those connections. What is interesting is that the SDGs don't explicitly reference mental health and well-being. And I was wondering whether you think there should be a dedicated goal to this topic.
I'd argue yes. I mean, if you look at the economic cost of mental health problems, both those that are in the internalizing spectrum, so anxiety and depression, for example, and externalizing spectrum, such as antisocial behavior disorders, for instance, the cost is enormous. The economic cost is enormous. The human cost is enormous. We have costs associated with ability to work, so economic productivity, incarceration, hospitalization, and not to mention the sort of the human emotional and social costs, which we can't really measure in pounds or dollars. So I think that this is something that really touches the core of who we are as humans. And it should absolutely be at the front and center of the sustained development goals.
So at the moment, sadly, we do not have a dedicated goal, but we do have targets or number of indicators which allude to or relate to mental health and well-being, including those which would address health, poverty, tackling substance abuse. And those are universal problems across wealthy countries, across less wealthy countries. What kind of interventions do you think we need to address these problems?
Yeah, so I should say here that when we designed our proposal for the Grand Challenges, the word intervention was central to it. So achieving change and improvement is central. So we want to identify what we call mechanisms, because that's our kind of background, the causal ways, the ways in which something improves. And if we identify how it improves and why it improves, then we can tune it up, we can make it even better. So that's kind of so much at the center of the Grand Challenges. And we want to incentivize cross-disciplinary work in bringing about good change, improvement. So that's what we consider as an intervention. Now, there are lots of different interventions that can be done. The good thing about doing interventions in our field is that one can do them as a causal probe, if you see what I mean, because you use randomization and a control, not invariably, but very often. So that means that you can do certain things. Now, it is very hard to randomize people, of course, to poverty and non-poverty. It would be completely unethical. But what people, as you know, have done is to say, well, it doesn't matter whether poverty is causal or not, which it may be in having, you know, poor mental health. But is it possible that if we tackled poverty, say that if I gave you money, something as simple, seemingly simple as that, if I gave you cash, that that would improve outcomes, including mental health? So this can be done in the context of a randomized controlled trial, or one could exploit what is called natural experiments. There's a very famous one in child mental health that happened in reservations in the United States, where suddenly a casino was opened randomly within a set of reservations. And this was a natural experiment because there was no particular reason why the people in that part of the reservation had the casino and not others. The thing was that the casino brought money to the community there. People had measured already mental health outcomes before that unintended intervention. When they went back after a few years, they found that those people who had benefited, who had got the money, so who were closest to that area, actually the outcomes of their children were better. They explained it through a mechanism that involved mothers having more time, parents having more time, but in that case, mothers having more time to be with their children, supervise them, whatever. So it was a very nice example of, you know, how you can exploit natural experiments, or in other cases, a randomization, to arrive at those causal inferences. So there's a multitude of ways of tackling both substance abuse and poverty. None of them is perfect, obviously, far from it. But there are so many things that could be tried and should be tried. Some have been tried, haven't worked. That's very interesting to know, despite best intentions, right? Some may even cause harm, but some will work, and they are worth doing. And there are designs in which to do it. And I think that this is absolutely the thing to do. One of my favorite kind of examples, just to understand the complexity of issues in oncology, in cancer research, which has seen dramatic developments in the last 20 years, is the Philadelphia chromosome. So there's a blood cancer called chronic myeloid leukemia. Someone discovered a very simple genetic mutation, I'll call it like that, it's a translocation actually, in the 1960s. It took 40 years to develop a drug based on that simple genetic defect. That was such a simple disorder. It's like, I don't know, in engineering terms, it's like, you know, I don't know, building a pencil. Mental health issues are like building an iPhone. It is going to take you longer, right? It is more complex.
Yes, and we know from genetics that mental health problems are influenced by hundreds, if not thousands, of genes, each of which increases the risk for developing disorder probabilistically a teeny tiny bit. So, you know, then trying to figure out how that genetic risk translates into mental health problems and under what environmental conditions. It's a formidable challenge, but there have already been some really interesting advances. And, you know, as more concentrated cross-disciplinary effort comes to bear on this research problem, I think we're going to see advances in the coming years. But I would also say in this context that in some cases, we may also want to think about how we can help people with mental health difficulties lead better lives. It's, as Argyris says, it's not realistic that everybody will be, in quotes, cured. And not everybody might even want to be. So there is also, you know, in addition to this idea of how can we shift the distribution, how can we get more people to be well, we may also want to invest effort and should invest effort. I think it would be morally appropriate to do so, to thinking about how can people with chronic mental health conditions lead a good life.
Yes. And for young people in particular, I don't know whether you would agree with this essay, it is also about what the expectation is of a good life versus, yes, you know, constant happiness. What constitutes a good life? And it's a very difficult question, because it's not a scientific question as such. It's a societal question. It's a value-based question, but a very important one, right? And it shapes your expectation about how you would be. And there's nothing worse than negative violations of your expectations. So adjustment of expectations about what it means to live, you know, in society is actually quite important.
It very much resonates with me. I'm from Finland, and Finland regularly tops the world happiness polls, which all the Finns find absolutely amusing, because we're not a particularly jolly nation. But I think actually what those surveys measure is general contentment. And I think we are a nation that is quite good at not expecting very much and being happy with their nice cup of coffee in the middle of the day. So I think that really speaks to what Arguri says about, you know, what are your expectations and how does your life measure up in relation to those expectations?
So when you're talking about expectations, I'm a paediatrician, you know, the early years are very important to me. And when you're bringing a child into the world, you know, there are expectations for that child. Do you think that actually, you know, we put a lot of funding on, like you said, treatment or later on in life? Do you think by shifting that to the early years more and thinking about mental wellness and creating children with more happiness, more mental wellness, supporting the positive engagement with the world that these young children need to have, would shift some of the balance in the mental health discipline?
So I would like to see both money devoted to the early years, but also maintained at the other bits of the distribution. So I often think of particularly very vulnerable children and families as something that need the early vaccination, that is the early intervention, but that will also need booster shots. Adolescence is another sensitive developmental period. So absolutely, I think everyone would argue about the importance of investing in the early years, into childhood, into adolescence, but not at the expense of taking the investments away from the, you know, other periods of the lifespan. And, you know, we're only starting to, for instance, understand women's health and its impact on mental health. And there are a number of sort of shifts in terms of both hormones and big life events and, you know, pregnancy, menopause, for instance, which we know have impact on mental health. We're only starting to research, you know, it's a lifelong journey. So I wouldn't advocate putting money to the early years at the expense of the other bits of the developmental span, but I would absolutely advocate the importance of adequately investing to children and young people. And then I think there is the question of what do we mean by promoting wellness? Would we assume that everyone should be happy all the time, which I don't think is probably a realistic proposition? Or would we be better off doing what Sir Mike Rutter argued some probably 40 years ago now, which is inoculating the children, sort of stealing the children against the inevitable stresses of life? And it doesn't mean that we go out of our way to kind of cause disappointment to our children, but in a way, helping the child to negotiate the inevitable disappointments that come along the way. And in fact, something that Argus and I talk about regularly is we're a little bit concerned about, actually, at least in the sort of middle class parents, what we see is this huge concern and anxiety about whether the child is happy all the time, and actually difficulty in tolerating negative feelings in the children. And actually, life sometimes has stresses and disappointments. And actually, I view my job as a parent as someone who scaffolds my children so that they can ride through those inevitable periods of difficulty without it becoming an all-crushing thing. Obviously, I'd rather they'd be happy most of the time, but I think that there is something to be sort of said also about what is it that constitutes promoting wellness, and what is wellness? Is it being happy all the time, or is it being content most of the time and being able to ride the difficult periods?
And since we're talking about expectations, I was thinking about social media, whether social media would have an impact on what we expect or societal expectations, and whether that has links with mental health and well-being.
So I might say something and I'll pass on to you as well, but I think it's a complex area of research. We don't have a lot of good data that would allow us to really understand what's going on. What we have out there at the moment suggests that it's not as simple as it's universally bad. For some children, it can actually be good. Aspects of it can be positive. Aspects of it can be negative. The children who seem to benefit are the ones who can engage with it with some level of agency and take the good bits that they like and not the bits that might be distressing. So my view would be that it would be a mistake to write it off wholesale and that we need a lot more research into who might benefit from what and how we might adequately support children in using it in positive rather than negative ways.
I completely agree. Just for those listeners of the podcast who may not be familiar with terms like confounding, one of the issues is in reverse causality is, are the children who are unhappy to start with, to put it very simply, the ones who are also more likely to use social media excessively, in which case, you know, the chicken and egg problem, right? So that's one of the fundamental issues that we have. We don't, it's very hard to find, to disentangle those things. And people are trying to do that. And, you know, there is some reasonable data suggesting results that suggest that, as you've heard, some of the children are probably affected by it. What exactly is affected? I mean, there are some very obvious things. Obviously, exposure to inappropriate material, which can happen through social media, is a very bad thing. And unlike how it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, now it can happen at a grand scale. So there are things, there are negative opportunities, as it were, that are afforded by social media, which we didn't have before at that scale. And those are clearly bad. But then similarly, you know, you can be in a very remote part of the world and you can, I don't know, watch Khan Academy. You know, it's amazing, right? So that's kind of social media. And then you can also connect with your friends and your family. You know, I was abroad, I was away from my family at a time when it was very expensive to talk on the phone. You know, now I could see the, you know, I can see the picture in front of me and just chat to them live. So those are amazing things and changes. So it's a question of balance and of doing really good research to arrive at the right, at the conclusions that we need as a society.
I agree. It's a question of balance and also kind of good science. And it feels that today there's been a really strong call for action, whether it's additional resources, but whether it's the right type of interventions at the right kind of stages of life for all groups and early interventions as well.
Yeah, one intervention that people said to me was, keep smiling. Every time you feel sad, smile. Seriously, I was at a wellness resort and talking about wellness, I was at a wellness resort and actually they said, if somebody looks at you and makes you feel low, just smile and you'll realise things get better. And I do that now. So an easy intervention to tell everybody that you know, just keep smiling every time you feel a little bit sad and it makes a difference. So on that note, thank
on
you very much.
On that happy note, keep smiling.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us today.
Yeah.
Where can listeners find you online?
By UCL.
Or UCL. Yeah. I think Google. We both have very peculiar names. If you spell them right, you will find us.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very hard to go wrong.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Unlocking the SDGs. This episode was presented by me, Professor Monica Lakhanpal.
And me, Professor Preeti Parikh.
And produced by the UCL SDGs Initiative and edited by Frontier. Our guests today were Professor Essie Veding and Professor Argiris Stringaris.
If you'd like to hear more podcasts from UCL, subscribe to UCL Minds wherever you download your podcasts or visit www.ucl.ac.uk/SDG. Join us next time on Unlocking the SDGs.